Good evening. We have two new faces tonight. Welcome to you both. Not new to me, but to most everybody. Let's do introductions around.
I'm Donna Lynn.
Well, welcome everyone. Jorge, you made it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Amazing. Amazing what we can endure. He's been having a lot of challenges lately. Met them all. We're going to start a study of the precepts tonight, of the Zen precepts, the Mahayana precepts. There are five books that will be helpful for you if you want to read something, but I don't... It's okay if you want to read something, but I'm not begging you to do that. It might help you. Maybe it'll just be more confusing. Eiken Roshi, many years ago, wrote The Mind of Clover, and he has a sort of social action attitude about them, too, about how to outreach as well as inreach. Dido Loy wrote The Heart of Being, which is about the whole process of ordination from beginning to end with great detail. It's probably the best book about this subject. And then Reb Anderson has written Being Upright, which is the one that most of the Zen Center people use and swear by. Then my friend Diane Rosetto, wrote a very nice little book called Waking Up to What You Do, which is what the precepts are exactly for. That's what they are, is wake-ups. And she uses her own story as a way and she's a housewife as well as a transmitted Zen teacher. Her teacher Joko Beck, thank you. I always forget Joko's name. But Joko Beck, who wrote wonderful books about everyday Zen, how to live the precepts, how to live this teaching. And then Thich Nhat Hanh, of course, has a book. He has so many books. I looked it up on the internet. It just goes on and on forever. And one of the, it's fairly, I don't know how new it is. It's called For a Future to be Possible. And it's in his own inimitable style. So Buddha called his movement, as he was doing his teaching, the Dhamma Vinaya. The Vinaya meaning the accumulation of vows and intentions that were developed as people began to practice and live together with him. It wasn't that he laid down all these rules and said, oh, you have to do this and this and this in order to be a good student. He waited until something happened, and then people would come to him and say, the very first one was, somebody named Fred, was addressed by his wife. His wife came to him and said, you know, we would inherit a lot of money if we had a son, and you've gone off and made this vow of chastity. If we could have a son, then we'd inherit, the money would keep on going in the family. Otherwise, it's gone. So he said, oh, fine. So he went home and made a baby with her. And some of the other monks heard about that and went to the Buddha and said, what about this? You know, make a vow. Shouldn't we keep it? And Buddha said, yes. Yes, we don't go home and make a baby with our wife after we've vowed not to do that. So little by little, this long list accumulated that became the kind of guiding light to everyone who practiced with Shakyamuni Buddha. He said the teaching and the practice rules, you could say, intentions, were the same. Disciplines, you could say, or ideals. So each was considered to be a step in training. And the way they used them is that they gathered together at the quarter moons, four times a month, and gathered in a circle like this and recited them. The men had, 227 of them. That's how many accumulated. And the women had 311. Lots more. They gathered and recited it one by one by one. And as the recitation came to one that you yourself had committed an offense, had broken your vow, you stood forward and said so. You know, a monk would say, oh, I'm sorry, Joe, I took your razor without asking you. I put it back, but even so, I took it without asking. And then Joe would say, well, that's okay, and please don't do it again, or something like that. And just ironed out just the little tense places that build up as people live together. It wasn't a perfect system, but it was one that in which everyone trusted each other because they were all coming from a place of zazen practice. And so the precepts themselves are coming from zazen practice. They're coming from our own deep intention to do our very best with full knowledge of how very limited we are and how hard it is. There's no expectation in Mahayana to be perfect. It's actually the difference between Theravadan and Mahayana, one of the big differences, and one that there was a schism at a certain point between followers after Buddha died, and they argued about the precepts. And the Mahayana, the Theravadins wanted to keep 10 of the precepts that they actually, most of them thought, could easily go. Buddha said when he was dying, you can sort out the precepts and you can put away and not use the ones that don't seem to make sense anymore. But then Ananda, who heard that, couldn't remember what Buddha said about which ones. So they had this big fight about it, this big argument. And the ones who wanted to keep all of them were the Theravadins, who went off and became practiced in the south, used Pali language, and created sutras and based their practice on trying to perfect themselves, truly perfect themselves, eradicate greed, anger, and ignorance, just grind it out of their body so that they could, when they died, go to nirvana. The Mahayana whole impulse was to stay, to practice not for getting out of here, but to deepen understanding in order to help sentient beings, to hold them and embrace them. So it's a very different turning. Although both are turning inward deeply and deeply practicing, there was this quite a large difference, such a large difference that two schools grew up, and then many schools out of there over the hundreds and hundreds of years. I'll tell you what the ten were that led to the split. One was handling money. In the Theravadin tradition, a monk does not handle money. If you go to Abhayagiri up in Redwood Valley, outside of Ukiah, the monks there live by these ten and all the other 300 or 200 and whatever it is. Exactly. Those monks have not touched money for many, many years. If you want to give money to Ajahn Pasano, you have to give it to somebody else who's allowed to hold money for him. Begging more than once is one of them. Eating after noon. In Buddhist time, you ate one large meal a day at noon. And at Abhayagiri, they have big wooden bowls and donated food, and it's always different every day. They put whatever they receive all in a bowl together. And it can be soup and potatoes and ice cream and broccoli and everything. And they, a friend was just telling me this the other day because she practices there. She said that somehow they managed to sort it out so it just goes in its own little place. And she said she can't do that. It's just a big gloppy mess. But the monks know how to make that work. And what they do, I've been there in the evening when you just have to get hungry at a certain point. They bring out candy. Candy and honey, all kinds of sweet things. And they call it medicine. It's to get them over the evening so they can last till breakfast time. One of them is storing salt to mix with food. Or consuming strong drink, carrying out official acts before everyone gets to have a say, holding separate ceremonies outside of the group, using a too big bowing. I don't know what that means, whether that means just a huge flourish or what. And interesting, this one, doing something that breaks the rules because your teacher does it. Interesting, eh? So, what I'd like to do is give you some material. This is the 10 precepts as they appear in the Pali. The original 10, more or less original 10 precepts before it broke up. And then this one is verses on the precepts. It's the list of the precepts, one by one, with two verses, one by Bodhidharma, presumably. Actually, it was much, much later in Japan that these were developed. This is a translation by Koban. So the first verse is, each one is by Koban. And it's a kind of expression of the absolute side of the precepts. So when we say no killing, that's the relative side, this side, the form side. We, this body, this mind, vow to do our best not to kill. But on the other hand, the absolute side is that life goes on. There is no killing life. So not to produce the view of extinction is the precept of not taking life. just the idea. So they're all like that. The second one is Dogen. So Dogen wrote a little verse for each one of the precepts also. As you can see, our precepts are very, very simple. They do not say, I will not kill, or even I vow not to kill. They say, no killing. No stealing. So it has all meanings in it. I won't kill. I will try my best not to kill. But also, we can't help it. I hope I made enough. When you take the precepts, you start out with a lot more material than this. You start out with the what's sometimes called the atonement or the at-one-ment, when you accept yourself with all your faults. And then you take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then you take the three pure precepts, and then you take the ten precepts, ten prohibitory precepts, so-called. But I'd like to start at at the end, because I think these are the most important and the most telling, and the most interesting for us in our daily life, which is what they're for. They're to wake us up to our own best nature. They're not to punish us or make us feel ashamed. We break everyone every day. It can't be helped. It's not about breaking them. It's about waking up to what we do when we do it. Oh, I just almost told a lie, I will say to myself, because I have them in me. And I took them in because it felt so much like how I really wanted to be. So, what I thought we could do is something we've done a number of times before, is take them one by one, take them home, and make a study of what happens. Just let what happens tell you. Maybe you have mice in the cupboard. Maybe you've got ants in the sink. Or maybe you're concerned about what's happening, where our tax money is going in Afghanistan. I mean, it has huge, numberless implications for us in how we live our life, in terms of being alive. The first one. The first one's very telling, very powerful subject, and one that we never can quite get to the bottom of. We do kill. And in Theravadin practice, usually the teaching is that you don't kill no matter what. And there's some, not the Theravadins, but the Jains, who actually filter their water before they drink it and take a broom and sweep in front of them before they walk. And if they're in the woods, they make loud noises so everything runs away. But of course now we know that we can't avoid it. Even so, there's no way. We're full inside and out of creatures. We're being lived by jillions and jillions of creatures inside. If we take an antibiotic, we're killing life. If we rub our eyebrows, there are whole villages living in our eyebrows, and psh, they're gone. So if we know this, it changes the attitude toward life itself, including our own life, and those of everything that we meet. Oh, this is another life. So if you can take it home, I'll bring you next week the whole list of the atonement and the refuges and all of that. But I thought this would be a nice start. And don't go any farther than the very first one, because that'll keep you busy. And maybe tell you a few things, too. And it changed my understanding of things. The first time I did this, it was a big subject in a little group that I was in. And somebody there took it home and came back saying that she had terrible problem with ants in her kitchen. And she couldn't make them go away. She tried everything, all the tricks and all the stuff. And they still kept coming and coming. And finally she got so fed up in the middle of the week when she was studying this that she stood in the doorway and she said, "If you don't go away by tomorrow morning, I'm going to get the poison out." And the next morning she came out and they were gone. So, I don't know that it's magic or how it affects living ants, but perhaps it does. Who knows? So maybe that's enough. Are there questions? Donna Lynn?
Did you say that this was Koval's translation?
Yes. There is a very, very thorough analysis of the precepts put that Gill created, big, thick book, and it uses Koban's translations for all the precepts, the whole thing, the whole ceremony, as well as others. But his are, I think he uses five of them, and he's in every single one.
Yeah, that was from
the. Yes, that's right. You gave it to me, and it's extremely helpful. Yeah. Sharon?
I know you just said maybe that's enough, but maybe you could say a little more.
Yeah.
About the first precept? Well, in the Mahayana tradition, there's a story about a ferry full of very wealthy merchants who are, I think this is a Tibetan story actually, who are taking big boxes full of jewels and things somewhere on a ferry. And a robber gets on the ferry and starts to kill them so he can get the jewels. And there's a monk on board, and the monk can decide whether he is going to save the life of the rest of the people on board or not. He could save them if he killed the robber, but then he would be breaking the precept. And there are many stories like this that they decide for the sake of others to break the precept. And if it means going to hell, okay. So it's a much more flexible, the Mahayana version is much more flexible about these. It's not that you have to hoe the line and be good like some Sunday school teacher is telling you. It's not like that. It's weighing what's the best for others and the self, how the situation can be harmonized and how it can work the best. So sometimes even killing, Suzuki Roshi talks about mashing earwigs. You know, sometimes you have to mash the earwigs. It's just the only way to have a garden. But you can do it with regret and apology. You know, I'm really, really sorry. But so as everything in this practice, there is no golden rule sitting up there somewhere shining down on us that we have to live up to. It's that we have to decide with real discrimination, moment by moment, how to live. It's our responsibility. And these are true guides for us to help us with that responsibility. Of course, it's easy to use them as, you know, kind of a little stick, you know, beat yourself. Oh, but that's not what it's for. It's to open things up. Is that enough?
That's a difficult question. Well, thank you.
Julian?
Yes, the whole idea of usually like the whole people, like rules tend to, I don't know, the way people approach them is kind of closing themselves off, making them more rigid.
Yes.
For example, like the notion of regret. What if I don't feel regret? I mean, maybe I'm just kind of concerned about ensuring that nothing that doesn't need to be added gets added. Or, you know what I'm...
No. Yeah. You can't paste these on your life and try to make yourself a good person. You're not going to be a perfect person anyway. But they do make it very clear where how we are moment by moment. Now, the one on lying is always so interesting because everybody thinks they don't lie, and yet as you take it through the week, you find you at least want to lie a number of times. It's protecting the self. It's all about, you know, building a... And these are to release that so that we're not so self-involved. We begin to open up to the other. Killing is about doing something out there to something else. Well, why are we doing that? You know, we begin to think, oh my, well, that's strange. The first one is Kobun's and the second one is Dogen's.
Kobun translates.
Yeah, it's really from the Tendai tradition on Mount Hiei in the I've forgotten when, but it's much, much later than Bodhidharma. They just call it the Bodhidharma precepts to get some importance thrown into it.
Because he doesn't talk about killing here. He talks about not to produce the view of extinction, which seems to be very...
Yes. Yes. Well, it's an idea. Death is an idea. And so if we cultivate the idea of death, then or the idea of extinction, then we're creating a whole scenario that doesn't have to be.
Things still die.
Yes.
The body that was once walking around is now lying there.
Yes. Yes.
It's there.
Whether
we took it, it's another story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's another way of turning form and emptiness, of understanding both sides. Which work simultaneously. They are the same. Even though our minds are so cut everything up into twos, we say it's this or that. It has to be this or that. But actually, it's all of it. And those Bodhidharma precepts are about the all of it side, the prajna side, the emptiness side. In which we live and bump our elbows and get bruised and drive our cars and eat our suppers. It's amazing.
What happens after
Yeah. There's a point where you can't say it anymore, which is why we sit. Well, it's 8. So thank you all. Thank you very much. Yes, yes. So every week we'll have a new one. And every week I'll bring you some background so that, but a little bit of background so that you all have a lot more time to talk and share your experiences.